Well, good evening, everyone, and let me welcome you to Lucy and the latest in our visiting speaker programme. It gives me great pleasure to welcome two very, very familiar names to us here at LSC. Well, Vesna here is obviously member of staff here, but Kenneth as well had been a visiting fellow here with us all a few years ago for tonight's presentation, which is Divergent Transition in the Sanjak, Causes and Consequences. I'll give a little bit of background on our two speakers to introduce them, but as I say, I think many of you will know both of them and the excellent work that they've been doing on Southeast Europe. Vesna is Associate Professorial Research Fellow and Conflict and Civil Society Research Unit in the LSE Department of International Development, specialising in informal economic practice, conflict and post-conflict economic recovery. She's the co-editor of Public Policy Making in the Western Balkans, Civil Society and Transitions in the Western Balkans. I seem to think that we worked together on that one. And then Persistent State Weakness in the Global Age and Transnationalism in the Balkans. Professor Kenneth Morrison is Professor of Modern Southeast European History at De Montfort University. He's the author of Montenegro, A Modern History, Sarajevo's Holiday Inn on the Frontline of Politics and War, and Nationalism, Identity and Statehood in Post-Yugoslav Montenegro, which has just actually come out just a few weeks ago, hasn't it? So it's last week, so really hot off the presses. And with Elizabeth Roberts, he's the co-author of The Sanjak History. He was in 2017 appointed Specialist Advisor on Balkan Politics for the House of Lords International Relations Select Committee. I don't know who wanted to start first, but you'll go first, right.
In the debate on the dissolution of former Yugoslavia and its consequences, Sanjak is often referred to as the last piece of a puzzle in recasting the political geography of Yugoslavia. And yet, despite all odds, Sanjak escaped an all-out war and instead has been going through a process of quite turbulent transition in which increasing inter-ethnic tensions have been a prominent feature. And I think this process is interesting from a scholarly perspective in that usually these kinds of transitions are approached either through a conflict lens or simply treated as another example of transition, post-communist transition modality where war dynamics is treated as an epiphenomena. So Sanjak is a relatively rare area of study, and Kenneth is undoubtedly one of the foremost authorities, and he commented when we were discussing this seminar tonight that he nearly fell off the chair when he heard that there was an interest at a British university to discuss Sanjak. So the existing scholarship on Sanjak primarily focuses on the history of the region and more recently on political developments, particularly on the topic of political autonomy in the context of Serbia's nation building. My study of Serbia's part of Sanjak takes an interdisciplinary perspective and has a different entry point of Kenneth. In that sense, the title of tonight's talk is slightly misleading in that you are not going to hear two nicely aligned presentations, a sort of pair comparison exercise. But I think while Kenneth will focus on the political dynamics in Montenegrin parts past over the last 20 years, and I will focus my study on the city of Novi Pazar, I think together we will provide a sort of a comprehensive take on the dynamics of transition in this region. So my work doesn't look explicitly into political dynamics, but it places these political dynamics within a broader process of social transformation and the consequences for sustainability of peace in this part of Sanjak. I conducted my research as part of a project on security and transition and its stream on cities and security, where we define security as a situated practice informed by ideas, everyday experience, and political action. So, you know, the approach and the findings are of a slightly different quality than simply focusing on the political dynamics. So I think we'll manage between the two of us to answer some questions and on the causes of these divergent trajectories, but I also am sure will raise some new ones. Just to briefly say, where does my interest in Sanjak come from? I think what I was intrigued by is that historically Sanjak always suffered when there were huge geopolitical changes that interrupted free circulation of people and goods. And because at the time Sanjak was established during the Ottoman time, Sanjak means new market. It developed into major trading post in that part of Europe, and besides Sarajevo, it was the second largest urban area in that part of Ottoman Empire, and also an important administrative hub. And in the early 1990s, while the rest of Yugoslavia was facing an economic freefall, things were actually quite different in Sanjak. It prospered economically. But then this everything changed when the new borders were erected between Serbia and Montenegro, and Sanjak was de facto partitioned between the two countries, and obviously with Kosovo's independence, another international border between Kosovo and Serbia was drawn. So this economic transformation was closely related to geopolitical dynamic, within which ethnic mobilization entwined with religious radicalization were central. And I was intrigued to understand, you know, how did this play out locally. And I tried to look into the question of why and how Sanjak escaped the war and what were the consequences. So in terms of analytical framework to answer this question, I found the debates on the social processes of war as an analytical frame persuasive, because I believe that focusing on discrete social actors and domains, political, religious, economic, and on the macro level of analysis cannot explain the processes of social transformation and their consequences during multiple transitions in Sanjak. What I mean by social processes is the transformation of social actors, structures, norms, and local practices that can leave profound social changes and influence transition process. And I focus on four such processes that have changed Novi Pazar as an urban space, and a place in which the political battle to redefine the relationships with the central state has been unfolding. And these four processes are political mobilization, transformation and polarization of social identities, norms transformation, and fragmentation of local political economy. Obviously, these processes take place in peaceful times, but in times of war, or in the case of Novi Pazar, its latent threat, they can radically change the pace, redirect them, or alter their consequences with perhaps irreversible effects. This framework was applied on a study of four conflicts: Sri Lanka, Peru, El Salvador, and Sierra Leone by Elizabeth Wood, but she looks at a much broader range of social processes. But my understanding of the kinds of issues facing Novi Pazar made me focus on these four. And I think this framework enables to look at how different elements and processes, economic, political, cultural forces, become conjoined, producing emergent forms and unpredictable outcomes in terms of societal dynamics that can affect trajectories of transition in terms of sustaining peace and stability at the local level, and how these processes affect this social change. I look at through the change in social relations and social networks, and I just feel that, and I'm convinced that in Novi Pazar, applying this kind of approach allows to answer some questions such as why it is difficult for civic parties to get a foothold in Sanjak. Why minority protection agenda has become the key political battleground, and to do so beyond looking at the elite politics only, but highlighting or foregrounding what happens at the societal level. So my presentation is organized around these four social processes and their consequences in terms of social transformation in social relations among different groups affected by those processes. So before I go over these four types of social processes and their consequences, let me just kind of give a brief sketch of Novi Pazar. We don't have a proper map, but it's a small room, so this may do. If you can see, James, if you can. It is the biggest urban area in this part, with some 130,000 inhabitants, and it is an informal political, economic, and cultural center in this part of Serbia. It experienced intensive demographic growth during the 2000s, when population went up by 10,000 within 10 years. But it also lost a significant percentage of population due to turbulent events in the surroundings. This is also one of the poorest areas in Serbia, in which every fourth person is unemployed, every tenth person receives social benefits. In 2013, it was defined as a devastated area, and the World Bank has classified it as actively impoverished area. Rate of unemployment is over 50% and is obviously much higher than the average rate of employment for Serbia. And it's also a city with the youngest population in Serbia, with some 33% of the population under the age of 25. It is also a place with vibrant political scene. Out of some 100 registered political parties, some 16%, which target Bosniak votes, are actually registered in Novi Pazar. So let me start by political mobilization. Political mobilization in Sanjak has its roots in the political and security developments during the final years of Yugoslavia and Serbia's shift towards the politics of exclusive ethnic nationalism, which was accompanied by increasingly hostile attitudes towards Muslims and Islam, including the Muslims living in Serbia. That population of Muslims in Serbia is actually the largest one outside of Bosnia in this part of Europe. In the 1990, a sister party of the Bosnian Party of Democratic Action was set up in Sanjak and led by Sulejman Ugljanin. And from then on, the political development in Serbian part of Sanjak has been closely linked to the efforts to resolve conflict in Bosnia. What has happened is that Bosnia has been acting as de facto kin state to the Bosniaks living in Serbian part of Sanjak, supporting different political options, but also different factions within the Islamic community in Serbia. And immediately after the Party of Democratic Action was set up in Sanjak, Alija Izetbegović, who at the time was heading the Party of Democratic Action in Bosnia, said openly that should Yugoslavia fall apart, Sanjak should ask for political autonomy. And of course, the other channel of influence on the political developments in that part of Sanjak came from the Serbian regime, which was also kind of meddling into political establishment and religious establishment of Sanjak's Bosniaks. So the outbreak of war in Bosnia was actually a milestone event in Sanjak's history, and this is when the Bosniak leadership in Sanjak really pressed on with the self-determination agenda to redefine Sanjak's status, and when it started demanding greater autonomy in the form of more decentralized and regionalized governance. And that was a very strong reaction in Serbia, because the plight of Sanjak's Bosnians was framed as part of Islamic resurgence, threatening Sanjak's recession. So regime engaged in active suppression of the political movement, particularly in the period between 91 and 95. And according to some accounts, some 17,000 people were interrogated during that period, accused of plotting to set up a separate state and of possessing arms. There were sort of informal talks or informative investigation, which often included physical torture and beating. And according to James Lyon, who for a good period of time was the head of International Crisis Group, 1990s were an era of terror marked by ethnic cleansing, human rights abuses, and discriminations. And according to the Helsinki Committee for Human Rights in Sanjak, by the end of 1996, police searched over 1,000 homes for guns, took 446 persons into custody, and 422 people were physically maltreated. Besides that kind of direct violence, there was active discrimination against Bosniak population. Many Bosniaks lost jobs in state-owned enterprises, and also were discriminated in trying to open jobs, get permission to set up businesses, and this often involved paying bribes to Serbian authorities. Novi Pazar also endured a three-month siege by the Serbian armed forces when the artillery was positioned on the hills around Novi Pazar. So there was a warning, there was a threat, should anything happen, that Serbian government and military wasn't going to allow it. And also, that part of Sanjak was vulnerable because of its proximity to the Bosnian borders and frequent crossings of various paramilitary troops. So there were all kinds of atrocities and violence going on during those years. So there was this experience of direct violence, and a threat of it was basically fomenting kind of antagonism among the Bosnian population, which really at the start of all of this was very pro-unity, pro-Serbian. There was that very strong idea of brotherhood and unity embraced among the population more generally, but this experience really changed that drastically. And then similarly, among local Serbian population, there was this, what Cheryl talks about, bilateral mobilization. There was a mobilization among the local Serb population that increasingly started looking to Belgrade for protection. So the effect of this were felt in increasingly in distancing of the local population, and allegiances were split between the SDR, the Sanjak Democratic Party of Rasim Ljajić at the time, and then two Islamic communities that each harbored their own agenda, and over time entered into pragmatic alliances with Serbian political establishment and which with each other. What I mean by this with each other, I mean Ljajić and Ugljanin were together when they set up the Party of Democratic Action in the 1990, only to part ways over time and become bitter rivals in fighting for the Bosnian votes, to come back again full circle more recently, where they again try have some kind of collaboration. But all this was framed by this kind of instrumental use of politics, because as things change within Serbia, the changes on the Serbian political scene, the local Bosniak parties were also changing their priorities. So from political agenda that was focused on autonomy, when it suited them, they kind of lowered the bar to cultural autonomy. Or when the SDI was in opposition, i.e. when Ugljan's party was in opposition, they would whip up this autonomy agenda again. So, and similarly, Mufti Zukorlić, who played quite controversial role, changed colors over time from, you know, the time when he was collaborating with Djindjic's government and when he was kind of supportive of some kind of arrangement that would give a degree of cultural autonomy to the Bosniak, then he changed to being a kind of very antagonistic, very critical of the Serbian regimes. And not to mention that now he's part of Serbian government. So over these years, I mean, all these parties survive. I mean, through this kind of politics changing and pragmatically aligning their agenda. But it's interesting that all three actually have maintained their position and still drive the political process in Serbia's Sanjak, which is now firmly within the minority protection agenda. While, of course, when you talk about political mobilization, all these things that I have mentioned are relevant. I mean, there is an economic subtext to that as well, because the other important aspect of social changes triggered by the political mobilization was struggle for the control of local government. So before 1990s, most of these institutions were dominated by Serbian staff, basically the judiciary, the police, educational institutions. So what the Bosniak side took in its stride was to change this balance, and of course a lot of that has to do with the fact that jobs are scarce. I mean, the public sector provides over 60% of employment in Novi Pazar. So what is framed as the kind of minority discrimination and struggle to reverse the imbalance of the composition of employment in public sector has actually a very strong economic subset, and because those jobs also serve as, or control over those jobs also serves as a source of patronage. And there's an interesting study on youth and corruption in Sanjak, where a young man tells his story of being interviewed for a job, where he says, "You are very good, you are creative, you are excellent, but you are not one of us. This is not how you get a job." So when the Bosniak took over local government, they actually started the process of discrimination against the Serbs. I mean, what they had experienced previously now was just turned towards the Serbs. And thirdly, I think important aspect of this political mobilization dynamic relates to civil society, because all of these political parties and the Islamic community itself were setting up their own non-governmental organizations. So through them, they were also able to mobilize the public. So moving on to the polarization of transformation and polarization of identity in Sanjak, as I said, initially there was a strong pro-Yugoslav sentiment and a sense of unity, but over time there has been an increasing trend of differentiation and different political loyalties reflected in voting patterns, where Bosniaks in Novi Pazar overwhelmingly vote for the ethnic parties and, of course, the parties affiliated to Mufti Zukorlić, in contrast to their neighbors that support Serbian political bloc. But again, as I said before, I mean, the picture is more complex. There is also an economic aspect to it, because loyalty or proximity to the party determines access to opportunities, job included. The reason for resurgence of religion is closely linked to general dysfunction of state institutions in this part of Serbia during the 1990s. So there was a cultural, social and value vacuum that the religious institutions stepped in. And these different political and religious loyalties among Bosniaks and Serb communities have affected everyday security and relations in the city in multiple ways. And I think one of the most visible ones is an increasing segregation in urban neighborhoods. And whereas before the early 1990s, Novi Pazar didn't have this kind of clear settlements, ethnically homogenous settlements, that all began to change during the 1990s, and some kind of, to some extent, it's only maintained in the former socialist era tower blocks. But that again, it's also quite small. Otherwise, there is an increasing polarization and segregation inside the city. I mean, an important element of this process of identity transformation and polarization is the presence of Wahhabis. I mean, their arrival it has changed kind of the atmosphere in the city. Their concentration in some parts of the city, notably in the old part of the city, has created a virtual no-go zones for non-Bosniaks, but for many Bosniaks as well. Their dress code, their behavior, the issues around observance of religious holidays, all create this kind of symbolic polarization and differentiation within the local population. And again, you know, this picture becomes is always more complex than it seems. It's not just about the religious impact they have. They're also important welfare providers. They provide different kind of public services. They clean streets sometimes. They provide wood for poor families. They do painting for poor families, basically doing the kind of provision that the state doesn't do. And that has effect on kind of polarizing local communities, because Novi Pazar is poor. People are dependent on various kinds of assistance. So there is clear discrimination between those who get that assistance from Wahhabis and those that do not. So gradually, you know, through these processes, what is happening are these old neighborhood networks and relations are dissolving. And according to the head of one of the most prominent Novi Pazar NGOs, Damad, she says Novi Pazar operates as two parallel universes, a Bosniak one and Serb one. Of course, the polarization is perhaps most palpable between the Bosniaks and the Serbs, but it also runs very deeply within the Bosniak and within the Serbian communities as well. And it is always primarily on religious or even political grounds. And when you talk to people in Novi Pazar, you know, they define themselves as Rasims, Suljos, and Muftis. So they belong to three camps, three political leaders that represent them. And just an example, I was interviewing someone who happened to be a Bosniak and had a colleague in the office who was Bosniak himself. We had a very interesting conversation, and then when his colleague left the room, I had this barrage of information that he felt uncomfortable sharing in front of his colleagues, because the colleague is one who supports Wahhabis, and he just felt uncomfortable and probably threatened by saying something to someone like myself that, you know, wasn't agreeable to the other person. And then you have, you know, other kind of changes in the cultural scene in Novi Pazar that really reinforce this cultural division, because while before the 1990s, Novi Pazar had quite a vibrant cultural scene. It is equally vibrant, but now it all comes with this religious kind of hat. I mean, what you have a race, but it's a Ramadan race. You have a poetry festival, but it's linked to some religious holiday, or it has some kind of name that really re-emphasizes that it is more than a cultural event, and that itself also is kind of affecting interethnic relations in the town, and as I said, within Bosnia community itself. The third of these social processes are the ones that capture relate to norm change. And demographic change, religious radicalization, and weak governance are some of the factors that have been reshaping normative frameworks for handling urban conditions where identity has come to define sources of opportunity. Since the 1990s, Novi Pazar has undergone deep demographic change, and I just gave you some statistics a little while ago. But people have been kind of leaving constantly to Bosnia, to other parts of Serbia, to Turkey, and further afield. And at the same time, there has been a strong influx of population from other parts of the region, but also from rural other parts of broader region. By that, I mean from Bosnia, from Kosovo, even from Macedonia, but also from rural areas in Sanjak, and that this has had clear impact on the cultural and urban fabric of the city, as newcomers often embrace different worldviews and different, more aggressive forms of communication and interacting. the influx of this rural population, for example, is linked to an explosion in illegal construction building in Novi Pazar. Many of new homes or new business premises actually have been built without legal permission, which has gone unsanctioned due to weak local governance and corruption. So for the local population, this problem of illegal building is really a manifestation of weak rule of law. And this perception of an inefficient and arbitrary state among the citizens is reinforced by instances of high-level corruption implicating local political, economic, and religious figures that have gone also unsanctioned, and that reinforce the feeling of vulnerability among local population, particularly minorities. And I think what came striking to me, you know, in all this conversation is how people have accepted that this kind of going about one's life, this kind of informal rule breaking, rule disrespecting behavior is simply the only way to survive. And I think, in terms of norm changing, again, I'll give you a little example. I was walking in the old town, and then underneath a shop window of one of the jewelry stores, there was a sign saying that, naming a couple who had borrowed the money from the owner of the shop and did not repay, and therefore the owner of the shop bans them from entering the shop. So for me, what did this capture is really this kind of disenchantment with the legal system in the city, and kind of going back to the old forms of trust, which was the foundation for him to lend this money in the first place, and hoping that some of that would have more effect than kind of going down the legal way. I think I'm aware that I've kind of gone over time massively, and fragmentation of local political economy is such an important part of the story. But I think I will just say a sentence or two, and we can get back to it in the conversation. But I think what happened was that Novi Pazar suffered huge kind of economic destruction. It was a process of massive deindustrialization and the destruction of productive capacity. But during that period of the 1990s, the textile economy and textile manufacturing and shoe manufacturing actually boomed. And that was the time when Serbia was under sanction, there was no kind of regulation, and when this area made the most of its connection to Turkish diaspora and of that unregulated space. And by 1995, roughly, there were about 500 workshops producing textile and shoes, and sort of annual turnover was anywhere between $10 and $20 million. And this economy benefited enormously both Bosniaks and Serbs, and actually helped preserve the inter-ethnic relations, which at that time were increasingly strained by regime's politics towards the Bosniaks. But of course, this all came crashing down when the borders new borders were drawn, and Serbian state kind of stepped up its regulatory role. And this kind of this boom in informal economy during that time really relied on trust and good neighborly relations. That was what was the foundation of this kind of informal business. And once that boom ended, the shock to the local economy has been such that basically it has never recovered from that. And you know, the other aspect of this fragmentation of political economy is linked to failed privatization in this area. Many cases of corruption that really have stunted development of formal economy. And of course, like in many other parts of the Balkans, this kind comes with proliferation of networks linking political, military, criminal elites, and obviously in Novi Pazar, also religious elite, because Mufti Zukorlić, as well as being a religious leader, maverick politician, is a very, very astute businessman as well. And part of the reasons why you know there were the two Islamic communities and tensions among them are as much about kind of spiritual leadership as they are about preserving economic interests, because both Zukorlić and Zilkić control vast economic resources, mosques, land, educational institutions, etc. So just to kind of wrap up, you know, having looked at the four social processes, what is the legacy on social change in Novi Pazar, and what does this mean in terms of prospect for sustaining peace in Novi Pazar? I'm not saying there's going to be war in Novi Pazar. I think that's not an option. But in my paper, I make a point that Novi Pazar is a peaceful but unsettled place. Inter-ethnic tensions, which exist along deep rifts within the Bosniak community, and occasional overt violence fueled by cultural radicalization and divisive politics, have become a feature of everyday life. Economic decay, weak governance, hostile political economy characterized by inequality and privilege are legacies of the social processes that characterize transition in Novi Pazar. Traditional tolerance and good neighborly relations seem to have given way to formalizing intercultural dialogue in the framework of minority protection agenda. When I say there's not going to be war in Novi Pazar, it reminds me how one of my interlocutors says, you know, Novi Pazar is peaceful because people don't mix anymore. They don't mix physically, or they don't talk about possibly sensitive topics, you know, that ruin friendships, that ruin also family relationships. And what you see is a clear disconnect between the elite politics and what really the people on the ground are asking for. And again, the same person said to me, oh, you know, elite's agenda is about the airport, it is about highway, whereas local people are concerned about water, electricity, waste disposal. And one of the arguments is why kind of this discrepancy is that it's also enabling local political elites to divert the attention of the kind of economic interests that they have been able to protect in that context. So on a final note, I think what has started as an elite project to a large degree associated with partisan politics of Sanjak Bosniak leadership, of protecting minorities from the alleged injustices of the Serbian state, has been turned into everyday experience of polarization among and within communities that changes the parameters of political action. While Serbian Sanjak Bosniaks have been granted cultural autonomy, this has been at the detriment of inter-ethnic relations and relations within Bosniak community. This is not to say that the impact is irreversible, but it does raise the question how best to address it. So I'll end here with my apologies for a very, very long speech.
Thank you. I'm obviously very familiar with everything Vesna said about Sanjak, having spent quite a long time in Novi Pazar witnessing some of these events, the split within the two factions of the Islamic community, the political squabbles between the SDP and the SDA. It's really quite striking, the contrast between so-called Serbian Sanjak and Montenegrin Sanjak. So if you go to Novi Pazar, for example, you see symbols of Sanjak everywhere. They're omnipotent. If you go to the Montenegrin Sanjak, you actually don't. Really outside Rožaje, where you might see the odd Sanjak flag outside a mosque, for example, you rarely see any symbols of the Sanjak. And frankly, you rarely hear people in Montenegro speak about the idea of autonomous Sanjak. The debates and arguments that are taking place within Serbian Sanjak are not paralleled or mirrored in the Montenegrin context. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that Montenegrin context and how that differentiation was realised, because this is part of an internal political process in Montenegro that began really in 1997 with a split within the ruling Democratic Party of Socialists into pro and anti-Milosevic factions. Thereafter, Bosniaks and Bosniak political parties became an important coalition partner for the DPS, for Milo Djukanovic's DPS, and that transformed their fortunes, frankly. So a very different historical trajectory, a very different set of political conditions, and this is what I'll be talking about over the next, but I'll try and keep it short, 15, 20 minutes, something along those lines. We'd rarely hear of the Montenegrin Sanjak. But the term Sanjak is actually one that's almost been kind of, it's disappeared from the Montenegrin political lexicon. We rarely hear the term these days, even among politicians in the Bosniak party, for example. If we have heard about the Montenegrin Sanjak in the last few years, it's been, for example, about the migration of people, large amounts of people, hundreds in fact, leaving Rožaje in 2015 and seeking asylum in Germany. This is a lot to do, of course, with the economic situation in Rožaje, but also because the German government were offering very generous terms for people to come and claim asylum in Germany, which is why so many people from the north of Montenegro, both Bosniaks and Serbs, in fact, and Montenegrins, claimed asylum in Germany. There are challenges in the Montenegrin Sanjak, of course. There's the complete disappearance of state enterprises, very high unemployment rates, particularly among young people, a small and embattled private sector, and frankly, little tangible hope of that economic situation improving. In many households, there are no members of the family in employment, and older generations often survive on meagre state pensions, the payments of which are often delayed. Those who were born after the collapse of the socialist system have no pension provision at all. So this economic reality is common across northern Montenegro and by no means unique to Rožaje. Politically, however, the situation of Bosniaks in Montenegro stands in sharp contrast to those in the Serbian Sanjak, where tensions between political elites in Belgrade and Novi Pazar have festered for decades. The small exodus from this small part of Montenegrin Sanjak, Rožaje, was caused by economic hopelessness, not because of political persecution. Post-2006 elections, and in particular the elections of October 2012 and 2016, have produced a more complex governing coalition in Montenegro than in previous elections. As a consequence, Bosniak parties in Montenegro, particularly the Bosniak Party, have established a key role in political life. They're part of the government, albeit a coalition government dominated by one party, the Democratic Party of Socialists. Bosniak parties, given their status as vital coalition partners, now have greater opportunities to influence government policy in national matters and those matters of specific importance to them. In 2012 and 2016, the Bosniak party was pivotal in terms of their position as position as the DPS's coalition partners. But this position that they find themselves in nowadays is a very different position from the one that they experienced in the early 1990s. So if we consider now in the Montenegrin government, you have the Bosniak party hold three positions, one of three deputy prime ministers, who also holds the portfolio for regional development, and two other ministries, transport and maritime affairs, and labour and social welfare. Reaching such a status has been a long and often fraught process in the political landscape that has witnessed long periods of flux, uncertainty and change. In the early 1990s, as the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia was disintegrating, Montenegro, while avoiding war, witnessed the persecution of the Republic's Bosniak Muslim population. Indeed, in an atmosphere of mutual distrust and uncertainty, Bosniak parties and those they represented faced marginalisation and, on occasion, outright persecution. That situation was transformed in 1997 when an intra-elite conflict within the ranks of the ruling DPS inexorably led to a split that would fundamentally alter the dynamics of Montenegrin politics. And they had significant consequences for ethnic minority parties in Montenegro, Bosniak parties, but also Albanian parties. In the wake of this split, ethnic minority parties would become crucial allies for Milo Djukanovic's post-split anti-Milosevic DPS, and they would provide strong support for the DPS's policy vis-à-vis the Milosevic regime in Serbia. A decade later, they would play a significant role in Montenegro's independence referendum. And in the first 6 years of Montenegro's independence, minority parties, particularly Bosniak parties, would play an increasingly important role in the governance of the country. Bosniaks in Montenegro are concentrated in the municipalities of Berane, Bjelopolje, Plevlja, Rožaje and Plav. These are the so-called five old Sanjak municipalities in Montenegro. But it has to be said there are two more now since 2013 at Petnica, which was part of the Berane municipality until 2013, is now a separate municipality. Gusinje is now a separate municipality. Gusinje and Plav were together until 2014. So you actually have seven Sanjak municipalities in Montenegro. Some of you will be aware that in the census of 1991, for example, 14.6% of the population in Montenegro defined themselves as Muslim, Muslimani, Muslim. But of course, debates thereafter about how one should refer to themselves, either as Muslim or Bosniak, the vast majority now, 8.65% describe themselves as Bosniaks, and 3.31% describe themselves as Muslims. So those debates that were taking place in the late 1990s, early 2000s about which name they should adopt, still ongoing to a certain extent, but you can see the vast majority of those who defined themselves Muslims in 1991 now define themselves Bosniaks. It's worth noting that within this community were the first ever, in Plav in fact, the first ever anti-Milosevic demonstrations in Montenegro during the so-called anti-bureaucratic revolution. In 1988 there were demonstrations in Plav. In November 1990, when the first multi-party elections were held in Montenegro, there was only one Muslim party of any significance, and this was the Montenegrin branch of the party that Vesna mentioned earlier on, Ali Izetbegović's SDA, which had a sister organisation in Serbia and one in Montenegro. The Montenegrin branch of the SDA was run by or led by Harun Hadžić. And what's really interesting, if you look at the difference between Suleiman Ugljanin in Serbia and Harun Hadžić in Montenegro, Harun Hadžić was far less supportive of Sanjak issues, the idea of autonomy for Sanjak. That idea was always much stronger in Serbia or among political elites within the SDA in Serbia than it was within political elites among the SDA in Montenegro. So, the vast majority of Montenegro's Muslims supported the SDA, and a smaller number were giving their support to this, either the Social Democratic Party or the Liberal Alliance of Montenegro. And the Liberal Alliance of Montenegro, an important party in this context, an anti-war party led by Slavko Perović, who was something of a legendary figure in Montenegrin politics of the early 1990s. Because of the anti-war message of the Liberal Alliance of Montenegro, many Montenegrin Muslims, in fact, joined the Liberal Alliance rather than joining the SDA. In October 1991, the Muslim National Council of Sanjak, led by Suleiman Ugljanin, held a referendum on autonomy in October 1991. The Montenegrin Muslims didn't participate in huge numbers in this referendum for autonomy. In Serbia, the numbers were much bigger. In Montenegro, they were small. And I think this was indicative, even then, of the fundamental differences between the Montenegrin and Serbian Sanjak. However, in 1992, particularly after the start of the war in Bosnia in April 1992, inter-ethnic tensions between Montenegrin Serbs and Muslims really suffered in these areas. So places like Berane, Bjelopolje, Plevlja, tensions were particularly acute in Pliavlia. In fact, pressure was applied on Muslims by not just local extremists, but also paramilitary groups coming from Serbia. Pljevlja's location is right next to the Bosnian border. So actually crossing from Pljevlja to go to, say, Rudo, for example, is 30 minutes in the car. And many of the so-called weekenders, or Serbian paramilitaries who were coming south, would often pass through Pljevlja, stop in Pljevlja, and then go on their way to Bosnia or Herzegovina. So this created a very difficult situation for Muslims in Pljevlja. As armed conflict broke out in Bosnia, this really intensified. And for a small period between May 1992 and about July 1992, the town was really controlled by a guy called Milica Čeko Dačević, who declared himself a voivoda and actually ran the town and intimidated local Muslims and so forth. So a period of real terror. It's interesting that Montenegrin newspaper Pobjeda, Serbian Politika, for example, they don't report on any of these issues that were going on in Montenegro at the time. The only two that were reporting about this was Monitor, the independent weekly based in Podgorica, and Vreme, the Serbian weekly, were covering events in Pljevlja. Now, of course, these events weren't sanctioned by the Montenegrin government, but generally they went largely unpunished. The Montenegrin government weren't acting to stop these paramilitaries. And the situation was deemed sufficiently serious for the president of the Federal Yugoslav Republic, then president of the Federal Yugoslav Republic, Dobrica Čosić, and Montenegrin president Momir Bulatović to visit the town to try and find a solution to the problem, which they did. They found a temporary solution to the problem then. But it gave a sign at that time that things were very tense and there could in fact be armed conflict because of Pljevlja's proximity to the Bosnian border. At the very same time, Harun Hadžić of the SDA was arguing that Muslims and Bosniaks in Montenegro were also facing persecution in Podgorica, Nikšić, Berane, throughout the country. Pressure was to increase, in fact, particularly on the SDA during 1993. In June 1993, there was an attempt by the Serbian authorities to arrest those members of the SDA in Serbia who they believed were plotting against the Serbian state. And these culminated in the so-called Novi Pazar trials of 1993. You then had a parallel process going on in Montenegro during so-called Akcija Lim, or Operation Lim, in which Montenegrin members of the Montenegrin branch of the SDA were arrested and charged with attempting to overthrow, attempting to launch an insurrection against the Montenegrin government. Some of those who were arrested, Harun Hadžić, the leader, Ibrahim Čikić, who was partially blind, so it was hard to imagine that Ibrahim Čikić would be organising such an event. He wrote a very good book about his experiences, actually. Jesunce ne grije, where the sun doesn't shine. You can find this book online, I think. It was published in Montenegro. It's a really interesting account of his time as a member of the party, but also during the trials in Bielopolje. This group was known as the Bielopolje group. And although in 1996 they were pardoned, after a total of 87 years in jail, seven members of them were given 87 years in jail. But then they were later pardoned by Momir Bulatović, the then president, Montenegrin president, in 1996. At that time, the Montenegrin political scene was changing significantly, and you had the beginnings of a kind of inter-elite conflict between Momir Bulatović's faction on one side, who was pro-Milosevic, and Milo Djukanovic's faction on the other side, which of course was anti-Milosevic. That split, and I won't go into the details, I'd like to, but I fear there's no time to go into the details of that split. Essentially what happened is that Djukanovic's faction wrested control of the DPS, but that DPS didn't have the same level of support as the previous monolithic DPS. So he had to appeal to minorities, he had to appeal to the Bosniaks, he had to appeal to the Albanians and so forth. And they were quite happy to join this anti-Milosevic coalition, even though Djukanovic, of course, had been Prime Minister of Montenegro during the time, 1992, when there were the events in Pljevlja, and when Bosnian refugees, Muslim Bosnian refugees, were rounded up in Herzegovina and Bar and so forth in the summer of 1992 and handed over to Karadzic's people in Foča. But in the context of this political struggle in Montenegro, Djukanovic was regarded as the lesser of two evils by the Bosniaks. And thereafter, you start to see a sort of coming together, and you start to see Bosniaks and Montenegro becoming much more part of the political mainstream. That's not to say that interethnic incidents didn't take place. There were issues in Plav throughout the mid-1990s. There was a famous football match that took place between FK Komovi. I don't know if any of you are particularly interested in second league or second division Montenegrin football, but the derby between FC Jezero of Plav and FC Komovi of Andrejevica is a particularly hot game. There can often be problems. And on this particular occasion, 1996, there was kind of large-scale disorder throughout at Plav as a consequence of the fans of FK Komovi with various paramilitary units and so forth visiting the town and roughing people up. So things were still going on, but the Montenegrin political landscape was changing. In terms of the Montenegrin independence referendum, I'll jump forward to that because I'm aware that we'd like to leave time for questions. After the fall of the Milosevic regime in October 2000, through the signing of the Belgrade Agreement 2002, the question of Montenegro's future status, of course, was dominated Montenegrin politics. In 2006, in March 2006, sorry, in February, 1 month before the independence referendum was announced, the Bosniak parties that existed, the small fragmented parties, got together and basically created the Bosniak party, which was founded in Rožaje by a citizen of Rožaje. And its stated objective was to represent Bosniaks and to ensure that the protection and emancipation of the national interests of the Bosniak peoples in Montenegro. Now, quite interesting case in terms of the referendum. The vast majority of Montenegro's Bosniaks supported the referendum, but a small group did not. And what was really interesting, and they... Have I got time? Just before the referendum, during the referendum campaign, I went to a number of pro-union and pro-independence events, and one was particularly interesting in Bijelo Polje. The leader, or the one-time leader of the SDA, Harun Hadžić, was standing there sharing the stage with people that were for the state union. So he was for the state union because he didn't want Sanjak to be divided. But the Bosniak party were for independence because they believed that Bosniak national interests in Montenegro would be better advanced by being independent. And what was really interesting is that you had Harun Hadžić sharing the stage with the very same political forces that may have oppressed him in the early 1990s. But he was opposing independence. So the vast majority of Bosniaks voted for independence, but there were those that wanted to preserve the joint state of Serbia and Montenegro. Now, after the independence referendum, Bosniak parties have become, of course, part of the governing coalitions. The Bosniak party were in a coalition with the Liberal Party in 2009, that later joined the DPS-led Coalition for a European Montenegro, securing three seats in Parliament. And that process has continued. So while the Bosniak party might talk about encouraging the Montenegrin government to recognise the Sanjak as a distinct cross-border area, they don't tend to talk about Sanjak-wide issues. The Bosniak party contested the 2012 elections independently. They formed an alliance after the elections with the DPS, and they secured three seats in Parliament. And in December of that year, the Bosniak party leader, Rafet Husovic, was named one of four deputy prime ministers. Again, in the last elections in 2016, although they lost one seat overall, the Bosniak party remained a key coalition partner in the government. And what's interesting is before that new government was formed, they were approached by the Democratic Front, by Nebojša Medeljevic, actually, the Democratic Front, to form an alliance with the opposition. But they chose to preserve their relationship that they had with the DPS. There is also the Bosniak Democratic Community in Montenegro, the president of which is Marmir Zukorlic. And what they've tried to do is inject kind of wider Bosniak issues or Sanjak issues into the Montenegrin political landscape. But what was really striking is that the BDZ, the Bosnian Democratic Community in Montenegro, performed really quite poorly in the elections. They didn't win any seats. And interestingly, they, since those elections, have tried to make a union with the Democratic Front, the main opposition party in Montenegro, sort of coming together to challenge the DPS. So I guess in conclusion, what we can say is that the Montenegrin political landscape is very different from the Serbian political landscape. And what's happened over the past 20 years is a complete divergence, essentially, between these two countries. So the politics of the Serbian Sanjak and the politics of the Montenegrin Sanjak are very, very different. Bosniaks and Bosniak parties are generally much more integrated into the political processes, into the government. Now, of course, whether those parties actually make a significant impact on government policy is another matter. But what we can say is that the tensions that are so manifest between political elites in Novi Pazar and Belgrade over the status of Sanjak and Bosniak national rights is not paralleled, or at least not as pronounced, in the Montenegrin context. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. We have about 20 minutes or so for questions. If anyone wants to ask a question, perhaps if you could, one, speak up so we can get it on the recording, if you are okay with that. And then also if you could perhaps identify yourself, so in the immediate. Cheryl.
Is there a way to think about parties in the city council context? These are municipalities, do they have different councils? Is there some kind of competition between these parties that differs by city? It's kind of an open question, just thinking about that kind of local politics rather than just the region and the parties.
Shall we take a couple of questions?
Okay.
I wanted to ask you a question in relation to polarization and fragmentation. What I would be really interested to know if, since you say that there is fragmentation going on between communities, Serbian community and Bosnian community, I'm interested if there is any cross-border activity between these small fragmented groups. Bosniaks and Serbs, do they collaborate? And Kenneth, I would like to ask you, you opened your presentation with telling us that there is in Montenegro, there is no discussion about autonomy of Sanjak. How much that is connected with the history of Montenegro and with the Greens and Whites? Is it connected with that, or what are the other elements which can explain to us the situation why there is no such a question for autonomy among Bosniaks or Muslims in Montenegro in comparison with Serbian Sanjak? Thank you.
Okay, I think we'll start with those.
Should we start with them? I'll start with the municipalities question first in the context of Montenegro, and then I'll pass over to you to discuss Serbia. Yeah, I mean, they're local. There's municipalities in Montenegro, and local elections are very important. Generally, Plav, Petnica, Rožaje tend to go to the Bosniak party. If they don't go to the Bosniak party, it's a coalition between DPS and the Bosniak party. So it gives them quite a lot of influence at local level, quite a good deal of power, actually, at local level. So in some ways, you could say that power is decentralized to local level, and the Bosniak party at local level have a good deal of influence over local affairs. But I'd still say that although Montenegro is divided into municipalities, that power is concentrated at the center and with one political party per se. So the municipalities themselves don't have huge budgets, they can't make decisions over big issues. They can make decisions over administering relatively small sums of money that are given to them by central government.
You have in the Serbian part, I mean, the division is roughly, you have three municipalities which are Bosniak dominated and then three which are Serb dominated. And you have a kind of, different combination of political parties in these municipalities. For example, one of the strongest ones politically is the municipality of Tutin, which has a different kind of political option, where SDA has been historically quite strong. Whereas in Novi Pazar, you have a long periods of Rasim Ljajić's party leading the government, and then Ugljanin and Zukorlić coming in. So there is that kind of inter-Bosniak dynamics playing out at the local level very strongly. I mean, this kind of tensions that I've been describing in Novi Pazar really go on in some of these municipalities, Bosniak municipalities. And in the Serbian municipalities, again, you have a different dynamic, different kind of political options, depending, you know, on what goes on in the broader Serbian political scene. So it's very much reflective of this factional squabbles, how local government works, how local governments are constituted. So you have that very present. You gonna go on, or shall I talk to Vesna's?
Yeah, I'll answer the question after you.
Okay. My research was really trying to look. There was this idea, this concept of urban capabilities. So whereas in this presentation, I have really focused on this kind of fragmentation and what pulls communities apart. There is so much of fighting back. There is so much of effort of different groups to work together, to collaborate. I mean, there's the Damad NGO, for example, has tried to organize all kinds of debates about the issues, but the problem is that NGO sector is actually quite weak, and there are all these other organizations which are linked to the political parties, which are linked to the Islamic communities, and these are small environments. Novi Pazar is small, so you know it's very difficult to break out of this constraint that has been created by this kind of politics. And then you have also media on top of that, which is absolutely controlled by the Islamic community and by the political parties. But leaving that aside, I mean, there is effort, there is activity to among people to work together and fight back. I mean, I have one of the conclusions of my study is that, you know, there is some kind of resilience, that there is civilian, that urban capability of people mixing and interacting and trying to find ways to overcome that quite palpable, despite all of this.
Yeah, I mean, to answer your question about Montenegro, why is the Sanjak question not really alive in Montenegro anymore? The reality is that if Bosniaks and Montenegro want to preserve their national rights and have a future in Montenegro, their best interests are actually to be incorporated as much as possible into the state. Which is the path that they've chosen. They've chosen not to focus on issues of Sanjak's autonomy and so forth, but they've been very pragmatic. From a historical perspective, there is... I don't think that the Greens and Whites and the conflict between those that were for a kind of more independent Montenegro and those that were for union with Serbia is too relevant. I think what is relevant is the fact that after 1878, and again in 1912, Montenegro expanded really significantly into areas in which, frankly, people didn't consider themselves Montenegrins or feel part or close to the dynasty of King Nikola I Petrovic. So King Nikola had to reach out to those minorities and incorporate them into the Montenegrin state, because otherwise Montenegro couldn't survive merely around Cetinje with King Nikola and his the cohort around him. So he had to reach out. And in 1912, as a consequence of the Balkan Wars, Plavin Gusinje, which had also been always been a sort of border territory, was incorporated into Montenegro. The only way, of course, to make Montenegro successful was to have those people think of themselves as citizens of the Montenegrin state. Now, of course, by 1918, Montenegro had ceased to exist. But there is a historical parallel there, that the relationships between the peripheries and the centre have perhaps been a little bit better in Montenegro than in Serbia, where there's been this kind of conflict between the peripheries and the centre, particularly in the context of Sanjak Muslims and Orthodox, the Orthodox majority in Serbia. So Montenegrin leaders, by sheer dint of the need to be pragmatic, have all taken historically a different approach.
Tim. I'm Tim Judah, a journalist. I work for The Economist. During the Bosnian War, there were, albeit not very many, there were some people in Bosnia, maybe in Sanjak, who sort of had a dream of a sort of greater Bosnia, perhaps. And perhaps that's what worried the Serbian police when they were clamping down. But obviously there were obviously not in any position to realise that. And in the last week or so, around Kosovo, there's been, it comes like a tide and then it goes away and comes like a tide and goes away. But there's been sort of talk about partition, exchange of territories again over Kosovo. And of course, we all know that the reason it's never happened is because of Macedonia and because of Bosnia. But I'm just interested, are there some people in Sarajevo or some people in Sanjak who think, aha, well, if this ever actually happens and the borders are redrawn around Kosovo, then this is our chance and then we should demand greater Bosnia. If we're going to lose all of Republika Srpska, then this is our moment. We should take back what's ours, and that's Sanjak.
Well, I'll take Jesse, yeah.
Ex-Oxford now, an active strategy. I had a question about actually the influence of SDA and Bosnian politicians on both of the Sanjaks and how they differ, and the same with the Islamic community. And again, whether that's where we can kind of tease out the differences in terms of direct support, indirect support, and institutional support, and how that has kind of, because that has changed dramatically as well. Sorry.
First address the question about the idea of carving out some sort of territory, Sanjak territory. If you look at the map, it's not viable because Bosnia is not conjoined to Sanjak physically. So you have, in the Serbian Sanjak, for example, between Sanjak and Bosnia, you have three Sanjak municipalities that are majority Serbian. So you have Priboj, you have Nova Varoš, and then you have... the mixed Pirjepolje, which is mixed. So there, it's not as if there's a sort of geographical, it doesn't make sense. There'd be a lot of resistance to that. In the Montenegrin Sanjak, I think, as I've discussed, the issue is not live. And again, you have that problem with proximity. Plijevlija is majority Serb, and that stands between them and Rožaje, for example. So if Tutin, Sjenica, and Novi Pazar and Rožaje bordered Bosnia-Herzegovina proper, then I think you'd have a different situation and people might make a case or attempt to make a case for that. But I think the way that the distribution of populations is, I think it's impossible. That's not to say that the idea isn't still alive. People do talk about this Sanjak question. And in Novi Pazar in particular, I mean, very different from Montenegro. If you walk around the market, you can buy Sanjak flags, you can buy Sanjak football kit for a football team that doesn't exist, but you can nevertheless buy it. You can buy mementos saying Sanjak on them. There's a real sense of Sanjak being something distinct in Serbia. And that's something that you don't see, I think, mirrored in Montenegro.
Yeah. I think I'll take Jess's question. I think the support to, you know, both to the political parties in Sanjak and to the Islamic community from the Bosnian side has been absolutely fundamental to how the events have turned up in Sanjak. I mean, it was support to the Islamic community in setting up Islamic community in Novi Pazar, I mean, because Zukorlić was a member of the SDA, Bosnian SDA at the time. I mean, he was the one who was with Ugljanin's support effectively nominated to be a mufti. And I think that support went all the way, you know, to the Islamic community associated with mufti until Rais Ceric was at the helm of the Bosnian Islamic community. And that was a very vitriolic kind of partnership that really did a lot of harm to Sanjak case, if you like, to Bosnia case, because Ceric was interfering blatantly into Sanjak's affair. I think now that with Rais Kavazovic in Bosnia taking over, things have changed. I mean, Zukorlić has lost that support. Actually, he's lost his religious status. I mean, now he's a politician, and because he's breached the rules of the Meshihad, he can never go back to being a mufti, ever. I mean, and so, you know, his time is over. And then for a long time, you know, it was SDA in Sanjak, Serbian Sanjak, really functioned as one with the Bosnian SDA. And that again has now changed. I think Ugljanin is a Finnish commodity in a way. I mean, it's a matter of time when he will have to leave. He doesn't enjoy support among the Bosnian SDA at the moment. But that support from Bosnia was absolutely fundamental. And what I, you know, to the point where Ugljanin talks about. You know, I was reading recently the Bosnian Council issued a statement about the new textbooks for the schools in Sanjak, and he said now the Sanjak Bosniak children will have the opportunity to study in their mother tongue. So Bosnia is a mother country. I mean that's how they frame it, and
so
that's
no one knows what the language school in Bosnia.
You know, which makes the whole kind of instrumentalization argument really plays itself out very strongly. Not that it explains fully what goes on, but it's there, and I just find it difficult to understand, because when you speak to them, they speak Ekavica. Mm-hmm. People in Novi Pazar speak Ekavica, and I'm not denying that kind of minority protection agenda merits you know, its place and its attention as well. But by the time, you know, this nitpicking process is over, to establish what divides these people that until yesterday lived together, it's going to be a rough ride for everyone.
I'll just one additional thing about the Montenegrin SDA. The Montenegrin SDA ceased to exist, so they're essentially replaced by the Bosniak Party, who have a completely different approach, and of course they don't have the same links to Sarajevo as the Sanjak SDA and Ugljanin's party, which still have very strong links to Sarajevo. And incidentally, not everyone in the Bosnian SDA supports Ugljanin or his policies, but that relationship still exists. In the Montenegrin context, again, because of the transformations of political parties, Bosniak political parties in Montenegro, it's a very different picture. And that's also the same with the Islamska Zajednica, the Islamic community of Montenegro is much closer to the centre, much closer to the government than is the case with Serbia.
We're almost out of time, Lee.
Thank you. I'm Petra Balazic. I'm a master's student here at LSE. So I have a question, two questions actually. First would be, in light of what Professor Morrison said about there not really being this political platform of Sanjak in Montenegro, I was wondering to what extent we can talk about Sanjak as an awareness of it being a transborder sort of region in the Serbian Sanjak. So to what extent do people think about it as not something that is confined to their immediate environment in Serbia, but rather as a joint region? And also was wondering whether the idea of Sanjak in Serbian Sanjak is more a thing of culture, or is it politically contested in terms of what Sanjak should be, how it should be? So from Bosniak Serbian perspective, what its values should be, what its political future should be.
So that, okay. I think there is awareness that Sanjak is a border region, because trans-border region, because the economy depends very much on these trans-border links. I mean, every time, as I said, you know, the new borders that have been created have really been detrimental for the legal economy in particular. But even the changes in the trading regime with Kosovo have affected the economy, and so there is a sense that some kind of arrangement that would remove this kind of obstacles would be beneficial, would be desirable, and there is that's it. And I think that's on the economic side, but I also think culturally there is still a very strong perception that there is a common bond. Even though across Sanjak, in Montenegrin and Serbian part, despite of this border that now divides them, so that is my my sense. Whether Serbia Sanjak is whether it is contested, I think what has happened is that there is no common vision what Serbian Sanjak should be. I mean, and this is one of the key issues, really, that is a festering wound across the political spectrum, both within the Bosniak and the Serbian community. I mean, there are different visions where Sanjak should be in new Serbia in relation to new government, to the central government. So that is a very kind of divisive issue across political spectrum, in that, you know, remains to be seen how it will play out, because the political fortunes of these three key political leaders that have dominated the political scene in Serbian Sanjak over the last 20 years are changing. I mean, they are definitely, I think, both Ljajic and Ugljanin are losing influence and their status at the local level. I mean, what happens to them, it's a different story. But Zukorlić as well. I mean, he's losing support. Whether that will unlock some new dynamic in which a new forces, sort of new ideas, how best to position Sanjak in Serbia will come. Who knows? That's it.
Just to finish, I completely agree. There's no, in Serbian Sanjak, a kind of united vision about what that should mean. and really for the last 20 years, the main dynamic, in certainly in Novi Pazar, is actually not between Serbs and Bosniaks. It's been intra-Bosniak. It's been between Zukorlic, Ugljanin, and Ljajic, and the squabbles that they're fighting. It's been very much a kind of intra-Bosniak situation. As you're absolutely right, things are beginning to change. Ugljanin is, you know, Ljajic, both spend more time in Belgrade, less time in Novi Pazar. Both are coming probably to the end of their political careers. Zukorlic cannot return now to become mufti in Novi Pazar. So, yeah, things will change. Things will evolve. It's not clear how they will evolve. But there is no clear vision about what the Sanjak's future status should be. In terms of the trans-border region, well, there's no denying that Montenegrin Bosniaks and Serbian Bosniaks and Bosniaks in Bosnia, yes, have huge, you know, very, very close cultural relations. You have situation, because of the imposition of the border between Serbia and Montenegro, you have the same families being divided by a border. So you have some living in Rožaje and others living in Tutin. And of course, for them, that's really created a very difficult situation. And just because there are boundaries and borders there doesn't mean that the kind of idea of being a Bosniak belonging to a Sanjak region, that still exists. But whether it has any political clout or any, there's any future for anything than being other than a sort of shared, imagined community, essentially, I think that's questionable.
Thank you very much indeed. Before I sort of give a formal thank you, just to make a couple of announcements about events that we've got coming up. So next Tuesday is a conference which has been co-organised by LISI on citizens' basic income. And this actually promises to be a very, very interesting day indeed, to discuss the idea of basic income and draw on findings from Serbia, Scotland, Namibia, India, Kenya, Finland, and research on US and Canadian experiments from the 1970s. That will be over in the Sorswe Hock building, and you need to register for anyone who might be interested in that. I think you can find it on the LISI website. There's a link over, and there's two parts. There's a morning and afternoon, so you register either for both or either which takes your interest. The second is on Monday the 5th of March. We have the next visiting speaker program, and that's going to be Dr. Max Frass, who's a visiting fellow here at LISI, and that's on government policy towards civil society in Albania. And then on Thursday the 8th of March, we're doing a book launch of Dimitar Bechev, who's a former visiting fellow here at LISI, and his book Rival Power, Russia in Southeast Europe. So three great events coming up. And that just leaves me to say thank you very, very much to our two speakers this evening. I think it's been absolutely fascinating hearing this story of Sanjak told from two very different perspectives. And, you know, I think we were incredibly fortunate to have such interesting and you know, really up-to-date research on these two parts, if you like, of a single area, if we think of it, but not really. So thank you very much, both of you, indeed, for the talks this evening. Thank you.